massacre against civilians had been conducted in the village of Kalogi in South Kordofan. Diplomats heard during the presentation of the new report on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Sometimes the situation and the facts are distorted, so we want to shed light on the developments in the country, and also we know that now the UN is saying that Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis, and so we would like to see why the situation is going in that direction, and what is the magnitude of this humanitarian crisis, and also what is the support that we can get from our partners in the international community.
The new report sheds further light on the UAE's technological and military assistance of the RSF militia. The report says that the shortest way to achieve peace and end the suffering of the Sudanese people is to hold the UAE accountable for its aggression. However, a recent EU Parliament resolution removed the mention of the UAE at the last minute.
The UAE are supporter of the RSF rebels, but after some diplomatic interventions by the UAE, the European Parliament opted to address, which is called on the world, foreign countries that influence the conflict.
We will keep providing humanitarian aid to ease the suffering of the Sudanese people. Sustainable and safe delivery of humanitarian aid in Sudan remains to be an urgent need to ensure uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid.
On Tuesday, an aid convoy of the World Food Programme was attacked in Hamra El Sheikh in North Darfur. It was the sixth such attack this year that has so far led to the killing of 8 World Food Programme workers since the beginning of the year.
It's the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. 30 million people are dependent on humanitarian aid, 15 million of them children. There are 10 million internally displaced people in the country. We're active in Sudan in principle and want to increase our efforts. But there are regions like Al-Fashir that are inaccessible to safe access.
Two unprecedented humanitarian crises, famine and genocide, have been unfolding in Sudan and Gaza. Although witnessed by millions online, the international community remains unable and unwilling to stop them. Economic and political ties with the perpetrators and states supporting them, most notably the US and the UAE, seem to be more important than human lives in West Asia and Africa. Dieter Reinisch from United Nations in Vienna.
Iran is preparing to host a fresh and potentially decisive round of mediation between Pakistan and Afghanistan's Taliban regime next week, in what is being viewed as the most ambitious diplomatic effort yet to break the deadlock between the two hostile neighbors. The Tehran talks stand out due to the anticipated participation of China and Russia, signaling that leading regional powers now view the escalating Pakistan rift as a direct challenge to wider regional stability. The Tehran initiative follows deadly border clashes between the two uneasy neighbors and earlier rounds of negotiations in Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, none of which produced a breakthrough.
This is a significant development, and what makes the Tehran talks particularly noteworthy is the expected participation of China and Russia. Their involvement signals that major regional players view this standoff between Pakistan and Afghanistan not just as a bilateral issue, but as a potential threat to wider regional stability. Tehran is leveraging both its political weight and the presence of two regional powers to create pressure for dialogue and compromise.
This mediation effort follows recent visits by Iran's senior security and diplomatic officials, reflecting Tehran's urgency to calm rising tensions between Islamabad and Kabul.
Since we have seen the Israeli occupation in Palestine and we have seen the atrocities of Israel, we have seen the very positive, very impactful role of Iran in the region. Iran has started maintaining its foreign relations with the other and neighboring countries. So I believe that Iran this time could be important mediator as compared to the other one, being as I have already mentioned, that immediate neighbor, being a stakeholder, also having projects with India, being a stake. Because we have been blaming Afghanistan that their land is being used by India in creating proxies in Pakistan. So I believe this time we have a mediator that could play a better role than the previous ones.
In the run-up to next week's meeting, Iranian diplomats have intensified shuttle contact with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
With tensions at their highest in years between Islamabad and Kabul, the Tehran mediation round will test whether coordinated pressure from Iran, supported by China and Russia, can open a path toward restoring trust and containing cross-border threats destabilizing the region. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries, those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices and it is then forgotten. Well, Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire. The massacres continue. The genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was observed at the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa compound in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa. A ceremony was held on Tuesday, bringing together representatives from the UN, the African Union, and ambassadors from various countries. The event highlighted decades of suffering faced by the Palestinian people, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
The Palestinian people's suffering has intensified under decades of a belligerent Israeli occupation, which has relentlessly targeted our land, the people, and every aspect of life in Palestine, culminating in an atrocious genocide in the Gaza Strip, confirmed by numerous UN and international human rights reports.
Injustice also continues in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, with Israel military operations, settlers, violence, settlement expansions, evictions, demolitions, and threats of annexations. At the same time, hundreds of humanitarian workers have been killed. The majority were Palestinians, UN staff, marking the largest loss of personnel in the organization's history. More journalists have perished than in any other conflict since the Second World War.
Participants expressed support for the Palestinians' legitimate rights, including the right to have independent states.
The Middle East region will not be able to emerge from the successive crises unless the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people to establish his own independent state are recognized.
Despite the UN's annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people and global calls to address the ongoing crisis, Palestinians continue to face a grave ordeal in the history of humanity. And this event in Addis Ababa urges the international community to move beyond rhetoric and support the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people in their quest for self-determination.
As we reflect on the hardship endured by millions of Palestinians, we are reminded that solidarity is not merely symbolic. It is a moral imperative. It is a wake-up call to the international community to redouble its commitment.
The event concluded with the 40 exhibition featuring the tragedies occurring in Gaza, honoring ambassadors whose countries have recognized the state of Palestine, and the flag-raising ceremony. Amanil Gabramatin, Addis Ababa.
Thank you.
Salam and welcome, friends, near and far. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran, and I'll be your guide through a rich tapestry of sound stories of faith, voices of thought, and the pulse of a world in motion. Keep listening, because what's ahead is worth your time. Our next program is Leader's Speech. Listen to English translations of selected segments and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on various important occasions. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. Next up, we have Africa Today. For now, please stay with us for Leader's Speech.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27th, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. What I want to say here is that we have certain concepts in the Quran which really build a powerful and glorious life for the Islamic Ummah. They are really a source of liberation from difficulties for the Islamic Ummah. We have such concepts in the Quran. In order to implement these concepts, we should primarily instill them into Muslims' minds in Islamic societies. We should act in a way that these concepts become transparent for the Islamic community, so much so that nothing can stop them from moving forward. We have serious problems at this stage. We should do something to turn these concepts into well-established norms and common thoughts among all the masses of the people in the Islamic Ummah. This is a task that should be carried out in the area of the Quran. All these meetings, gatherings, recitations, and efforts to memorize the Quran, all of which are necessary and good, are an introduction to that public understanding.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to mention one of these concepts as an example. God says, Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 256. This is a concept. This is a principle. Rejecting evil and believing in God is a principle. We have divided the whole world into two zones. One is the area where evil exerts its influence, which should be rejected by us, and another zone, which is the area where God exerts his influence. We should believe in this zone. This is faith-based identity versus evil-based identity. Of course, this does not mean that we should constantly fight against everyone who believes in evil-based identity. It does not mean that we should kill them, that we should disconnect ourselves from them, and we should stop exchanging knowledge and information with them. Rather, it means that our faith-based identity should be independent and have clear boundaries so that we can protect ourselves, achieve perfection, and move forward in the face of evil-based identity.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Ever wondered where body organs such as kidneys, hearts, and eyes that are meant for transplantation are stored and what happens to them in the interim that they wait for a new home? In this episode, our story begins where technology becomes the guardian of human life, from the coldest temperatures to the warmest hopes, from small laboratories to grand national projects. Join us on a journey to the world of Danish Pajuhish Faj, where Iranian innovation speaks the language of life and saving lives, and a journey to the place where human organs are stored at 86 degrees below zero. Juhasz Fash Company is among the oldest and one of the pioneering companies in Iran that manufactures equipment for storing plasma, blood products, body organs, and tissues. It has been beating at the heart of Iran's biomedical industry for over two decades. Its name synonymous with trust and innovation.
Our company was founded in Tehran in 1995. The goal of establishing this company was to manufacture medical and laboratory equipment related to blood banks and the Blood Transfusion Organization. We realized that the equipment used by the Blood Transfusion Organization wasn't anything extraordinarily complex. This complex was being imported from abroad. In any case, we began designing, drafting plans, and carrying out the work. Given that I'm a mechanical design engineer myself, specializing in solid mechanics, we embarked on this project. Along with my brother, who had some information due to his involvement with the Blood Transfusion Organization and was very curious about how these devices were built, we started this venture under these circumstances. We began from a small office in Tehran and approached the Blood Transfusion Organization. At that time, we took our designs and ideas, built a small prototype, showed it to them, and they trusted us, entering into a contract with us. This effort has led us to where we are today. We are now proud to say that Danish Pajuhan Company has manufactured close to 20,000 units of various models of blood bank refrigerators for storing blood bags, platelet incubators, plasma storage freezers, and the A1 cell culture incubator, and a minus 80 degrees centigrade ultra-low temperature freezers for preserving tissues and bodily organs, which are present in most research centers across Iran. It is our honor that we have installation and commissioning representatives as well as service teams across Iran for this equipment, and we are actively working in this field. And most interestingly and importantly, some of the devices we first built nearly 27 or 28 years ago are still operational and used at certain centers. This is our pride, a source of happiness, and it gives us the strength to work with even greater determination. Currently, we are also producing research equipment, as I mentioned, such as the A1 cell culture incubator used for producing drugs like clotting factors and insulin. In pharmaceutical centers such as Daru Heshmi, for the first time in Iran, we manufactured and delivered our device to them, and it is being used. Other pharmaceutical centers also use our equipment, including our minus 80 degrees centigrade ultra-low temperature freezer. For the first time, and in response to the country's needs, we even designed it with two separate refrigeration cycles. Due to the servicing challenges in our country and the device's reliance on high technology, we innovated by using two independent systems for the first time. This ensures that if one cycle fails, the other continues to operate fully, preventing any damage to the valuable blood products or research materials. This is a distinct advantage over similar foreign devices. Of course, this approach is more costly for us, but given the operational conditions and our commitment to localization, it stands as a positive achievement for Danish Pajuhan Company and a source of pride for our work in this field. Furthermore, in the production of the cell culture device, it is worth noting that there are no more than three or four companies worldwide that manufacture this equipment. One of them is Danish Pajuhan Fash Company. We are proud to have produced this device, and it is now being utilized in pharmaceutical centers.
What you just heard was just part of the long and challenging path of Danish Pajuhan Fash Company, the path of turning an idea into a series of national and international achievements. The CEO clearly explained how the company managed to find its special place in Iran's biomedical industry through innovation and indigenous knowledge. But the important question is, what is plasma factor 8 and what is its significance?
Plasma, the golden yellow component of blood, is rich with vital proteins. Among these proteins, factor 8 plays a pivotal role in the blood clotting process, and its absence puts hemophilia patients at risk of dangerous bleeding. The production cycle of factor 8 from plasma begins with collecting plasma from healthy donors. The samples undergo rigorous virological and safety screening to ensure their initial safety. Then, using advanced separation methods, the various plasma proteins are isolated. At this stage, factor VIII is extracted as cryoprecipitate and purified using modern chromatography technology. To make the product safe, viral inactivation processes are carried out, including nanofiltration and controlled heat treatment, which guarantee that the final medication is free from pathogens. In the end, the purified factor VIII is packaged as a lyophilized powder or a ready-to-use solution. Each vial with a specific dosage is prepared for injection into patients with hemophilia A.
In the research and development R&D unit of our company, we have strived to develop and manufacture equipment for the country under the banner of Danish Pejuhan Company to support the pharmaceutical sector and the storage of plasma and blood products nationwide. The device you see in the image is a blast device, a plasma freezer. It can reduce the temperature of plasma from approximately plus 50 degrees Celsius down to minus 50 degrees Celsius in under an hour, typically within 45 minutes. This unit features four shelves. Each shelf can hold six plasma units, totaling 24 units. Therefore, 24 plasma units can reach minus 50 degrees Celsius in less than 1 hour. Every component of this device has been planned and manufactured by the company's engineers. This includes the refrigeration systems, the electronic systems, and the embedded software programming. The data loggers you see in the image are also entirely built by Danish Pejuhan Company and Iranian engineers. As you can observe, all temperature data and device information are logged. You can extract graphs from it. Temperature graphs are displayed. It has a USB port for downloading data in formats like PDF and Excel, for viewing graphs, and also for monitoring device alarms. All device alarms are displayed in real time on the unit itself. This device is the Danish Pejuhan Company's minus 80 degrees Celsius freezer. This single-door freezer features a dual independent refrigeration system, two separate cooling circuits. It can bring the internal temperature down to minus 80 degrees Celsius. This device is used in research centers. In biological, biotechnological, and pharmaceutical fields. As you can also observe in this device, it has two independent cooling circuits visible in the image, along with a data logger that monitors the entire system. This system can log temperature data for up to 2 years and store up to 8,000 alarm events internally. Look here, it shows an error, for example, a sensor fault in a cooling circuit. These are tests conducted by our own team. We can see everything here, upper and lower temperature limits, and all other parameters. This also has a USB port for Excel output. This device is the plasma recover, which can lower the plasma temperature from positive 25 degrees, which is room temperature, to negative 25 degrees in a period of 3 hours. It has four completely independent chambers. This means you can place a plasma bag in each chamber. It is designed for plasma volumes from 150 to 200 milliliters and features four completely separate doors. The device you see in this image is the A1 cell culture incubator. It was used for producing factor VIII and the COVID-19 vaccine. During the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic in our country, when cases surged, they utilized this very device to manufacture the COVID-19 vaccine domestically. The device operates at 28 degrees Celsius. It features features a rolling bottle system. It can culture drugs using the nutrients medium poured into the bottles. These bottles rotate, and at temperatures of 40 degrees Celsius and 24 degrees Celsius, bacteria are introduced into the bottles via filters, which aids in improving the cell culture process.
Our manufacturing process in the factory consists of several units. There is a mechanical unit where the device's body is produced. We have the refrigeration unit, which designs and installs our cooling systems, and the electrical and electronics unit. Of course, before entering production, our design and engineering unit is highly active. It is comprised of university elites from our own country who worked hard here designing the product from scratch. They then hand over the designs to our production units. We have also done reverse engineering. There were devices that were reverse engineered, but we no longer rely on that method. For those devices, we did reverse engineer. We have fixed their flaws. Originally, American and European devices, they are now being produced to the highest standards for the Iranian Blood Transfusion Organization nationwide, as well as hospitals across the country. We have had significant achievements in the field of cell culture equipment. We have designed at least 5 distinct products in this area, from design to manufacturing, and they are now operational in various centers across the country. In our field, our annual production volume isn't very high because manufacturing our devices is complex. However, our factory is modern and well-equipped. The machinery and facilities we have are excellent. Similar factories we have seen in Europe and China were not superior to ours. But because these devices have specific complexities, our current annual production quantity is limited. The most important point is that the countries producing these devices have sanctioned us and refused to sell them to us. Yet, we have managed not only to design and produce these devices, but also to improve upon them. We can supply them to all centers in need across the country. This is a very positive point, and we are proud to be serving our nation in this capacity.
That's all for today. Another story of innovation and inspiration unfolded. Thank you. Be sure to tune in again for other interesting stories. Until next time, take care.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Irete Bakara Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chibuka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration. Basically, because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chibuka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AfCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly, we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. And must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
I definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative